Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
This is NPR News Presents. I'm Stephen John. This hour, a conversation with biographer Ron Chernow about his latest book, Grant. He spoke with host Kerry Miller about the renewed discussions around the Civil War.
Have you had a chance to digest what Mr. Kelly, the president's chief of staff, said about Robert E. Lee and the Civil War? And let me break it down a bit, if I might. On Lee, he was an honorable man, a man that gave up his country to fight for his state, which 150 years ago was more important than country.
Well, I confess, Kerry, I'm still reeling a little bit from this statement. You know, there's a sentimental story about Robert E. Lee that's told again and again, that when the Civil War broke out, he was actually asked to command the Union Army, but he said that his attachment to his home state of Virginia was so great that he felt that that superseded, you know, his loyalty to the federal government. But what I discovered as I got deeper into researching his life, and it's very hard to research Grant's life without researching Lee's life at the same time, was that he was a true believer in the Confederacy. He later said we were fighting for sacred principles. And he was a strong believer in the system of slavery. He claimed to oppose slavery in theory, but he said things like slavery was a painful form of discipline that was necessary to the black race to lift them to a higher level of civilization. Again, you tend not to read these statements about him. And so it's interesting because I think that there's a glorified image of Lee that lingers in the population that really started with something called the Lost Cause School. After the Civil War, when the South began to really rewrite the history of the Civil War and began to wrap the Confederacy in a kind of romantic haze. And so Robert E. Lee was presented not only as the superior general to Grant, but he was presented as a perfect Christian gentleman and an exemplary aristocratic character.
So Mr. Kelly used the word honorable man. Given what you've just said, it sounds like you would say that's not an appropriate description.
It's not. He was a brilliant general, but I find it interesting that if you look at Grant's record during the Civil War, Grant actually captured three Confederate armies at Fort Donelson in Tennessee in 1862. In Vicksburg, Mississippi in 1863, and most famously at Appomattox Courthouse in April 1865. Robert E. Lee never captured a single Union army. So why is it that Grant, who captured three Confederate armies, who is considered this brutal butcher and this inferior general, and Lee, who never captured a single army, was suddenly glorified into the great general of the war? It's very kind of striking to me, and kind of a large part of my book, that even though the North militarily won the Civil War, in many ways, politically, the South, after the Civil War, rolled back many of the gains promised by the war, particularly its promise of a fully biracial society. And then, as I said, the South, through this group of lost cause theorists, began to really idealize and romanticize the Confederacy. And strikes me as very interesting, Kerry, that to this day, the most famous Hollywood movie about the Civil War is Gone with the Wind, which completely subscribes to that romanticized view of the Confederacy, that the idea that the blacks were kind of happy and contented souls singing in the fields and fawning over their white masters in the house. So the North won the war militarily, but in many ways the South won the war politically.
Ron, how commonly shared is this idea that Mr. Kelly was also talking about, that the Civil War was about the inability to compromise? As has been pointed out, there was a lot of compromising that went on.
Well, I found this very interesting. You know, having written biographies of both Alexander Hamilton and George Washington, you know, our founding fathers, who were so wonderful, who created this terrific, you know, set of institutions and constitutions and bequeathed these great principles to us. But the one situation that they elected to defer to the future was slavery, and they took refuge in convenient and really self-serving fantasies that slavery would sort of gradually fade away, would wither away, or be kind of nicely legislated away. And the thing that surprised me, you know, the idea that there had not been attempts at compromise, there had been, you know, for 70 or 80 years, nothing but attempts to compromise. There were compromises actually built into the Constitution, the idea that the slave trade was protected for 20 years, the idea that for the purposes of, you know, electoral representation, every slave would count as 3/5 of a person. And then there were, you know, the famous compromises, 1820, the Missouri Compromise. Missouri's admitted as a slave state, Maine is a free state. 1850, you know, we had a compromise where the North suddenly had to go along with the Fugitive Slave Act, where Northerners were supposed to apprehend fugitive slaves. We then had the Kansas-Nebraska Act, where Kansas and Nebraska territories were supposed to choose whether they wanted to be free states or slave states. So I think that he really has stood history on its head. And in the last analysis, there was no compromise possible on slavery. There's no way of, as Lincoln said, being kind of half slave and, you know, half free.
When Kelly got into this, he was remarking on this debate about the proper place for Confederate statues. I wonder if you think that statues of Lee and someone like Jefferson Davis belong in a public square, or do they belong in a place where there is historical context?
No, it's a very good question because, you know, in doing biography of Ulysses S. Grant, since most of the Civil War and Grant's battles were fought in the South, I spent a lot of time doing research in Tennessee, in Mississippi, in Georgia, in Virginia, et cetera. You know, and what you notice if you travel in the South is that very often the Confederate monuments will stand directly in front of the courthouse or a city hall, you know, in a small town square. And what that says to me is not only an endorsement, you know, of the Confederate monuments, but really a glorification of the Confederacy. And I ended up doing a lot of research, both when I wrote the book and then afterwards, into the years after the Civil War, because these statues started going up. In fact, the first one that went up in 1875 was a Stonewall Jackson statue in Richmond, and it was, you know, 50,000 whites only. Blacks asked to, some blacks, believe it or not, asked to participate, and a black militia was forbidden. And there were many members of the Ku Klux Klan there. You know, so now these statues may be just standing alone on a street corner. But if one understands the political context when they were created, it was part of this kind of, you know, lost cause backlash against Reconstruction that I write about at great length in the book. And, you know, for many years, and this is certainly the way that it's taught in many Southern schools, that Reconstruction is presented as a complete fiasco of, you know, corrupt carpetbag politicians from the North and illiterate black legislators from the South. And there has been a major, major reappraisal of Reconstruction in recent years, led by people like Eric Foner at Columbia, and seeing Reconstruction as ultimately kind of a doomed experiment, but a very noble experiment in an attempt to create a fully biracial society. So we had during the Reconstruction years, and this really kind of overlaps very much with Grant's two terms as president, we had 600 blacks served in Southern legislatures. We had 14 black representatives in the U.S. House of Representatives. We had two blacks in the U.S. Senate. My favorite example, Hiram Revels, the first black senator who occupied the Senate seat that had been occupied by Jefferson Davis.
Wow.
You know, what could be lovelier symbolism than that? But the Confederate statues started going up towards the end of Grant's second term as president, and it was the South's backlash against Reconstruction. This was the South's way of communicating to the black community that status quo ante, that is kind of the antebellum system of white supremacy, was back, except that slavery was abolished, but then there was a form of involuntary servitude for many blacks that was very similar to slavery. So one has to understand the context in which these statues were created. And I think, go back to your initial question, forgive my rambling here, but my own feeling is that it's time for the statues to be removed, because, as I said, I think that where they are now does imply civic endorsement. But I would rather, I don't think that the best way of dealing with the problem is that you wake up one morning and the statue's gone, there's just a gaping hole in the ground. I would rather turn this, if you will, into a teachable moment, move the Confederate monuments into a local historical society where it's kind of a neutral setting, or move them into Confederate cemetery or whatever. But I think that there's possibly an opportunity in this whole kind of painful environment since Charlottesville, where we need to educate people about the Civil War and Reconstruction. We're at war with ourselves because it all boils down to the stories we tell each other, and there are these two competing narratives of the causes of the Civil War. In fact, I did, before the book came out, I did an informal poll of, I live in New York, I have about 7 or 8 friends who grew up in the South, and I asked them all to give me a memo about how the Civil War Reconstruction was taught. And there was variation. But the one thing that was consistent, every single person said that the cause of the Civil War, as they were taught in school, was states' rights. It's kind of interesting. Can you imagine 750,000 Americans were so concerned about states' rights that they were willing to die for states' rights? Does that sound plausible at all?
Wow.
And, of course, the interesting thing, if you go back to the period, the South not only made no bones about the fact that the war was about slavery, the South was proud of the fact that it was. In fact, the few weeks after the Confederacy was formed, the vice president of the Confederacy, Alexander Stephens, said that the cornerstone of the Confederacy was the idea that the black man was naturally inferior and that slavery was his natural state. And he said that the Confederacy was the first country in history built on that great truth. They were very proud of this. And if you look at the 11 states that seceded, if you look at their manifestos when they seceded and their reasons given, it was all about slavery. In fact, I have a quote in the book from James Longstreet, who was Robert E. Lee's chief commander, who when asked about the states' rights business, said, "Oh, gee, that's funny. During the 4 years of the war, I never heard anything but slavery mentioned as a reason for the war." This was Robert E. Lee's chief commander, who was honest enough to admit what every historian knows.
What you just said a minute ago about politics are the stories that we tell ourselves. And those stories, what's extraordinary about that is they still matter hundreds of years later to the idea of American identity.
No, absolutely.
Right?
I have felt, particularly in the wake of Charlottesville, I've felt such a sense of mission in terms of being a biographer or historian, whatever you want to call me, because I think that, reading history, it's more than a pleasant escape, on a summer afternoon. It really is a question of, who we are as a people.
Right.
Is not only defined by who we were, but what we remember about who we were and how these institutions come together. And I really feel, democracy is not just something that's written down in a constitution, on a parchment. It's not just a set of institutions. Democracy is our memory of the institutions and the events that kind of made us who we are. The democracy really exists in our mind. So I think that, we historians have really, kind of a very serious obligation just to preserve our democracy, to remind people of who we are and who we've been.
But what we're seeing here different versions of different stories that we're telling, the clash that comes out of those different versions of the stories about
who we are. And I think that, Southern identity is still very much wrapped around these Confederate symbols.
Why?
What I found, though, is that a lot of younger friends from the South seem to be much less attached to these symbols. I think that one can't understand American politics to this day without understanding what happened during Reconstruction, I found doing the book, obviously writing a lot about the Civil War, but also Reconstruction, I felt that the Civil War and Reconstruction are two acts of the same drama. And I've been very, very impressed as I've gone around the country, how many Americans know the Civil War in extraordinary detail. They know every battle, they know every general, and that's great. But to know everything about the Civil War and little or nothing about Reconstruction is a little bit like walking out in the middle of the play. You really don't know how the play ended, because what happens is, and I spend a lot of time talking about this in the book, that for the first year after the war, the South was chastened. But then a backlash began to develop, particularly Grant was, because Grant, after the war, is still general-in-chief for 4 years, and then he's two-term president. Grant is the single most important force behind the passage of the 15th Amendment, which gave blacks, at least black males, the right to vote. Okay, now think about this for a moment. Population of the South was 36% black, but there were two southern states, South Carolina and Mississippi, where blacks made up a majority of the population. So when the 15th Amendment is passed, the white South is petrified, that the blacks will actually dare to exercise the right to vote. And so what happens is the Ku Klux Klan, which starts out 1866 in a place called Pulaski, Tennessee, it starts out as a social club for Confederate veterans. Within a year, it begins to morph into militia groups, and then it kind of spreads throughout the South. And what the Klan was basically about terrorizing the black community into not exercising the right to vote. So they began to put on hoods and robes and get on horseback and at night terrorize blacks. And they murdered not tens, not hundreds, but thousands of blacks in the South. Thousands of blacks were murdered without a single prosecution. And so Grant begins to, one, send federal troops into the South. Number two, he appoints a crusading attorney general named Amos Ackerman, who uses the newly created Justice Department and brings 3,000 indictments against the Ku Klux Klan. At a time when there was no Southern white who would testify against a member of the Klan, there was no Southern jury that would convict a member of the Klan, there was no Southern sheriff who would arrest a member of the Klan. So Grant decides that since there has been a complete collapse of state and local government when it comes to prosecuting all these thousands of murders of blacks, that the federal government has to do it. So what happens is there is a violent backlash against Grant in the South, and he's accused of bayonet rule, he's accused of Caesarism. And Grant said that there was nothing that he did more unwillingly than send federal troops and federal marshals into the South. But he really felt that the South had given him, no choice. And unfortunately, you were asking kind of about the power of these Confederate symbols. A lot of the attitudes in Southern political culture were very much shaped during this period. And there became a sort of extreme version of states' rights, because this meant kind of, federal, interference in what was going on in terms of black-white relations. And so it also meant an extreme hostility to the federal government. And this has had a kind of continuing impact in American political life. So if you want to know why the South functioned as a solid South, and at first it was a solid Democratic South. Mm-hmm. Then after the Voting Rights Act of 1965 was signed by LBJ, it became a solid, Republican South. But you can't understand to this day why the South continues to function as a political unit in that way without sort of going back. So, you know, Faulkner, the famous Faulkner line, you know, the past is never dead. It's not even past.
Do you think Ulysses S. Grant gets enough credit for what he did for freed slaves and Black Americans
at
that time?
You know, there's been a tremendous change going on, not just my books, but a whole slew of books over the last 10 or 15 years. Because back in 1948, Arthur Schlesinger Jr., did a poll of presidential historians, you know, where they're kind of asked to rank the presidents in order. And Grant came in next to last. I think Warren Harding was at the bottom of the heap, but Grant was right down there in the basement with Warren Harding. Well, in the most recent poll, Grant placed number 22. So that's kind of quite a jump from the very bottom. Now he's kind of in the middle. I think he's going to go higher. And I think that there were two main stories in his administration. One was the scandals. And I discussed the scandals at great length in the book. They were important. But Grant was not personally involved in them.
Yes.
He did not personally condone them, and he personally prosecuted them vigorously. But Grant was an incurably naive man in certain ways. He was very blind to scoundrels in his midst. But that, you know, label has really, scandal-ridden administration has really tarnished his administration. What I try to show in the book, that those scandals in the 19th century, there were kind of scandals in every administration.
This is starting to feel familiar.
Yeah. But I argue that, you know, that was the minor story of the
right.
administration. I think that the major story was that between the time of Abraham Lincoln and LBJ, the single most important president by far for African Americans was Ulysses S. Grant. I'll just give you two quotes from Frederick Douglass, who, of course, was the leading Black leader at the time. And Douglass said, to Ulysses S. Grant, more than any other man, the Negro owes his enfranchisement. And the second, and he said this when Grant ran for re-election in 1872, he said, Grant has been the vigilant, impartial, firm, and wise protector of my race. And he was that highly regarded. And I think that, you know, now I like to think we're kind of much more sensitive to these racial issues than in past generations, and Grant's reputation has risen accordingly.
How do you think Grant came to that?
It's a wonderful question, because Grant grew up in a corner of southwestern Ohio, about an hour outside of where Cincinnati is today. And he's born on a very bucolic stretch of the Ohio River, with free Ohio on one side and then slave-owning Kentucky on the other. In fact, winter nights, the Ohio River would freeze over and fugitive slaves would, you know, sprint to freedom. So he was exposed to the conflict at a very early age. There was a lot of, he came from an abolitionist family. In fact, we talked about it. He married into a slave-owning family. So Grant is kind of, you know, straddling the divides. But what I discovered was, even going back to Grant's childhood, he was a very gentle boy. He was a very sensitive boy. And he seemed to have an instinctive sympathy with the underdog. So I have stories in the book that he saw bigger, older boys kind of picking on a younger boy, he would sort of roll up his sleeves and he would defend the younger boy. He loved animals. Nothing, one of the few things that could really inspire Grant to swear, was if he saw anyone maltreating an animal. So he seemed to have an instinctive sympathy with the underdog. And then even in the 1850s, when he's farming in St. Louis, he was actually working side by side in the fields with Black workers. And the whites in the neighborhood were horrified that any white man, you know, would do that. And he'd married into a slave-owning family. He did at one point, we're not entirely sure what the story was, but at one point he did own a slave named William Jones. And Grant was in financially a desperate situation. He was reduced to selling firewood on street corners in St. Louis. But he goes to the local courthouse, and he frees William Jones. And he could have gotten a lot of money for a slave at that time, money that he could really have used. He had a wife and four children. And I saw recently online that Ta-Nehisi Coates had read this in the book, and he said, I think that's the greatest act ever performed by a president before his presidency.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's kind of a lovely story.
So he is somebody who has an empathy with the underdog. As we were talking downstairs, I thought this was interesting. I was saying to Ron that one of the most meaningful things for me was learning about this relationship with Julia and Ulysses S. Grant. And Ron said, early on, women seemed to see Ulysses' potential in a way that the men around him didn't. I wonder why.
Well, you know, he was kind of, he was a gentle, quiet, modest, you know, rather sensitive man. He actually was sort of very strong. He was a great horseman. I mean, he had these sort of quote-unquote sort of manly qualities, but he was not, Grant was never your typical he-man. He was never your male chauvinist. In fact, he was extremely chaste. He would get very uncomfortable if people told off-color stories. He was always tremendously respectful of women. And it's interesting that, I tell the story in the book that during this terrible period of business failure, when he's trying to make a go of it as a farmer in the 1850s, and he's selling firewood on street corners in St. Louis. In fact, one of his old army buddies runs into him and says, Grant, what on earth are you doing? You can't imagine. He said, Grant, you know, was unshaven and unkempt. He said, Grant, what are you doing? And Grant said, I'm trying to settle the problem of poverty. And that winter, he was in such desperate straits that he had to pawn his watch to buy Christmas presents for his family. Anyways, right at around that time, and they're living in a log house that he's built called Hardscrabble. Right around that time, his wife, Julia, has a dream that Ulysses would become president of the United States someday. And when she tells the dream to her friends and family, they all laugh because nothing could have seemed more ridiculous. This man is fighting for his life and is having difficulty simply supporting his family. But she always felt that there were these kind of magical hidden talents that Grant had that would materialize in time. His mother-in-law felt the same way. And, you know, biography is all about character revealed under the force of circumstance. And what I felt about all the other books that I wrote was that I felt all of the people that I'd written about before, they were built for success. You start reading about an Alexander Hamilton, he's 14 years old, he's writing a letter that ends, I wish there was a war. See, he's already dreaming of fame. You know, whereas with Grant, there wasn't that kind of fire in the belly. And it required, you know, Washington, Hamilton, they would have succeeded in whatever they had set out to do in any period. Ulysses S. Grant, this is a case of someone who needed a very kind of specialized set of circumstances for these extraordinary qualities to begin to come out. So at the time that the Confederates fire on Fort Sumter, he's working as a junior clerk in his father's leather goods store in Galena, Illinois. Well, Confederates fire on Fort Sumter. Grant had gone to West Point. He'd fought in the Mexican War. 2 months after Fort Sumter, he's a colonel. And then 4 months later, he's a brigadier general. 10 months later, he's a major general. And 4 years later, he's general in chief of the Union Army with a million soldiers under his command. Before the war, he never had one person, you know, working for him. Now he has a million.
It's so extraordinary.
Working for him. Yeah, it's the most amazing transformation. He went from being Fortune's fool to Fortune's favorite, and then suddenly, you know, he soars and soars and soars, although there would continue to be kind of many ups and downs in his life.
You get the sense in reading your biographies of Washington and Hamilton that they were also leaders and men who knew that they were meant for great things and knew what they were good at. And I asked myself this often through the story of Grant, whether he really had knowledge of what he could be great at. I mean, how much self-awareness did he have?
Well, I think one of the paradoxes of Grant's life is that the thing that he was arguably greatest at, war, was something that he didn't especially like. You know, the story was that Grant didn't go to, you know, his parents one day and say, I wanted to go to West Point. Grant's overbearing father, Jesse Root Grant, announced to Grant one day that he was going to West Point. And why? Not because he saw Ulysses as this great warrior, but he was a real skinflint, and West Point for Jesse Grant represented a free form of vocational education. In fact, Grant, who had a kind of something he's often not credited with, sense of humor, he had a delightful dry wit. He said that when, you know, he was taking the train east to go to West Point, he kept hoping the train would break down. Even when he's at West Point, there was a debate going on in Congress about whether to abolish West Point, and Grant said that his dream was that Congress would succeed in abolishing West Point, you know, and he'd be put out of his misery. And so, but he has this extraordinary talent for war, but no relish in it. In fact, you know, Robert E. Lee, also great general, you know, the Battle of Fredericksburg, you know, makes the famous statement, you know, it's a good thing that war is so terrible, otherwise we would enjoy it so much. I mean, you know, and there have been many generals throughout history, you know, who did express a kind of keen excitement about it. You can't find a single line from Grant about that. So Grant, in this kind of grim and stoical fashion, marched through all these battles and was extraordinarily good. But one of the things that I love about the story is that this is the story of someone who was heroic who didn't set out to be heroic. There's a great line from Walt Whitman about Ulysses S. Grant. He said, nothing heroic and yet the greatest of heroes. And I think that when you, you know, read the story of Grant, he's not as a Washington or Hamilton or Rockefeller. He's, you know, he's not lusting for greatness or fame or power or money or any of those things. It's really the story of a man who is just doing his patriotic duty. And in the course of doing his patriotic duty as best he can, he just keeps rising and rising and rising because of his extraordinary competence in what he's doing. And so I think that this is a question of someone discovering qualities in himself. But I think, I mean, you ask a very, very interesting question because I kept wondering about Grant's level of confidence. But one thing that struck me in the story, and then, you know, he becomes general-in-chief. He becomes the first lieutenant general since George Washington. Then he's general-in-chief, you know, for 4 years, then president for 8 years. It's amazing how quickly and easily he incorporates all the success into his life and feels equal to it. So on some level, in spite of all the business failure and also lifelong struggle with alcoholism, as these extraordinary things and extraordinary powers come his way, he feels himself fully, fully equal to the task. And he said, I mean, he takes colossal risks as a general. So on some level, he must have had the most extraordinary belief in himself.
The other thing that strikes me about what I remember about reading Washington is that Washington seemed to have this well-developed sense of posterity, that he was living in historic times and that people would want to read about his role in that. I didn't get the sense that Grant, yes, he wrote his memoirs at the end of his life, but I didn't get the sense that he believed that of himself.
No, that's an excellent point in terms of Grant's modesty. I was very struck when I was doing the biography of George Washington that in the middle of the Revolutionary War, when Washington is complaining bitterly to Congress that he needs, you know, more men and, you know, and more money, more materiel, he asks a special appropriation from Congress for a team of secretaries who do nothing for 2 years in the middle of the Revolutionary War but create these beautiful volumes of his wartime papers. And then at the end of the war, He gets these beautiful trunks and he stores the papers. He won't let the papers travel by sea because he's afraid they'll go down. So he kind of has these papers and these beautiful trunks travel over land to Mount Vernon. You're absolutely right. He was fully aware of his place in history and wanted to preserve it. There's nothing like that with Grant. In fact, after the Civil War, there were all these generals who rushed to cash in, literally cash in on the Civil War by publishing their memoirs. And Grant thought that there was not only something kind of greedy about it, but egotistical, that they wanted to trumpet their accomplishments during the war, and he swore that he never would do it. But then what happened, and again, that bespeaks his extreme modesty.
It does.
What happens about a year before he dies, two terrible things happen simultaneously. He had all of his savings invested with a young man named Ferdinand Ward, who had been lionized as the young Napoleon of finance. And Grant thought that his investment with Ferdinand Ward, who was only 29 years old when they started, he thought that his investment had converted him into a multimillionaire. Well, he woke up one day to discover that the profits were all fictitious. It was a gigantic Ponzi scheme, and he was worth exactly $80. In other words, Ferdinand Ward was literally the Bernie Madoff of his day. All of Grant's sons had invested their life savings with Ferdinand Ward, so the entire family was just wiped out. Then, by terrible coincidence, around the same time, he was diagnosed with cancer of the throat and tongue. Grant, during the Civil War, smoked 20 cigars a day. The reason that he did was his first famous victory at Fort Donelson in Tennessee. One of the accounts of the battle had Grant riding around the battlefield with a cigar stub clenched in the corner of his mouth. When that appeared in the newspaper, he received from anonymous admirers 10,000 fine cigars. Grant had actually been a pipe smoker up until that point, but he happened to have a cigar that day. So I guess Grant, being Grant, had 10,000 free cigars there and began to freely avail himself. So anyway, so he simultaneously is wiped out financially and is diagnosed with cancer of the tongue and throat, which is a very, very gruesome way to die. So he's petrified that when he dies, that Julia will be left destitute, which was a real possibility. So he decides to write his memoirs, and his publisher is Mark Twain. And despite excruciating pain, Grant manages in 1 year to write, it's a long memoir, it's 335,000 words. It's considered the most brilliant military memoir in American letters, and Mark Twain, among others, thought it was a masterpiece that could rank alongside Caesar's commentaries. And Twain said that their style is flawless. No man can improve upon the style of Grant's memoirs.
I want you to read a bit from the Battle of Shiloh, but this goes to what we've just been talking about. Grant was also, it seems, willing to share a lot of the credit for the military strategy and the military accomplishments. And you tell us that there are plenty of other military leaders at that point that don't seem... He's very generous.
Yeah. I mean, he's particularly generous in his comments towards William Tecumseh Sherman and Phil Sheridan, and that's fully reciprocated. And he felt that either Sherman or Sheridan could have replaced him if he had been killed in battle. So I'll just read you a little bit from Shiloh. And I should say, Shiloh set a new benchmark for carnage in American history. It was the first time, I think, that Americans realized just how big and bloody this war was going to be. In a two-day period, there would be 24,000 casualties in this beautiful meadow in southern Tennessee. So I'll read you a little bit. The bucolic setting, with its gently rolling woods and scattered meadows, soon became a charnel house as the conflict devolved into the war's most harrowing battle. bodies of soldiers piled up in heaps as, quote, death with 50,000 mowers stalked over the field, wrote William Hillier, Grant's aide. The sky grew dark with acrid smoke, and the dense flight of bullets, producing a continuous patter like the rapid fall of lethal raindrops. The combined din of artillery and musketry reverberated endlessly. Despite his injury, Grant soon rode all over the battlefields, heedless of danger, quote, even in the midst of a shower of cannon and musket balls, wrote Hillier. Dogged, unshaken, never doubting the final outcome, Grant puffed coolly on his cigar, issuing orders, quote, as though he was simply reviewing the troops. When John Rawlins came up from Pittsburgh Landing searching for Grant, he told a fellow officer, we'll find him where the firing is heaviest, which turned out to be the case. A bullet that smashed the scabbard of his sword left Grant completely unfazed. Heavily outnumbered, facing more than 40,000 Confederate soldiers versus 33,000 in his own army, he was gratified by his men's valor under exceptionally terrifying circumstances. Shiloh was a free-for-all of death in which brute force trumped tactical subtleties. It was a case of Southern dash against Northern pluck and endurance, Grant wrote. By 10 a.m., he caught up with Sherman, who protected a pivotal position on the Union right that guarded the landing. Falling back at first, Sherman now made an obstinate stand against unrelenting assaults, showing magnificent courage. As if made of indestructible stuff, he stood caked with dust, his bloody hand bandaged, his arm in a sling from a bullet to his shoulder. Before the day ended, another bullet slashed harmlessly through his hat, and three horses were shot from under him. Grant was simply amazed at Sherman's adroit handling of his green soldiers.
You're listening to Talking Volumes at the Fitzgerald Theater with biographer Ron Chernow. His new book is titled Grant, and I'm Carrie Miller. We need to talk about Grant's drinking, the reality of it, but also the terrible rumors and stories that followed him for most of his life. I thought it was very interesting that you consulted Polly McCall. She was an addiction specialist. She gave you insight into Grant's drinking and addiction overall. What did you learn from her?
Well, it was interesting, you know, because I consulted not only Polly, who's a friend, but I spoke at length to many, many friends who had a history of alcoholism. And their observations about Grant were extremely interesting. I should explain that, you know, for 150 years, this mystery has persisted about Grant's drinking, because on the one hand, there were many, many, you know, people who accused him of drinking during the war, but often in the form of kind of malicious and anonymous, you know, letters. And then there were other people who had worked very closely with him, sometimes for weeks or months, who said that they never saw Grant drink. And so when I started the book, my dear friend Harold Holzer, who is one of the great living authorities on Lincoln, said, you know, Ron, it would be good to finally settle this, you know, mystery once and for all. And what I discovered was that apparent contradiction, people who said they saw him drinking and others who said never did, was that Grant was an episodic drinker. He was a binge drinker. He was not a daily drinker. He could go for 2-3 months without drinking. He had enough control over his drinking that he would never drink before a battle, certainly never drank during a battle. He was very responsible. He would never jeopardize his soldiers. But what I discovered was that there was a recurring pattern. After a battle, he would allow himself a trip to a town where his soldiers or staff could not see him. And then he would go on a 2 or 3 day bender. And then he would come back, as William Tecumseh Sherman said, kind of fresh as a rose, which is interesting. But, you know, when I would tell this to friends in AA, they all had the same reaction. They said, oh, he's what we call a high-functioning alcoholic, that he was able to have this very responsible position and, you know, periodically indulge in drinking. The other part of the story that's very interesting is I tell a story that when the war broke out, Grant had befriended in Galena a young lawyer named John Rollins, who was the son of an alcoholic, and invited Rollins onto his staff as his adjutant and effectively chief of staff. Rollins takes the position on one condition, that Grant promises him that he will not touch a drop of liquor during the war. He, Rollins, will call him on it and quit. Well, it was kind of very... it says something about Grant that he was willing to hire someone on this condition. Again, my friends in AA all had the same reaction. Oh, he took his sponsor onto his staff. <you know? laughs> Now, it's fascinating what happens between the two men, because Grant, in fact, has many lapses. Right. We know all about them from Rollins's letters. And Rollins is playing this strange double game, because privately, he's fiercely chastising Grant, while publicly reassuring Lincoln and Stanton that there's no problem, because Rollins was deeply patriotic. He felt the fate of the Union rested on Ulysses S. Grant, and so he's kind of protecting Grant while at the same time trying to keep him, you know, sober as often as he could.
He was also deeply disappointed in these lapses that Grant had.
Right? Yeah, he was absolutely messianic on the issue. The reason we know so much, I went through, it was very nice for a biographer that Rollins was writing an almost daily letter to his fiancée, then wife, about this, and Rollins was immensely frustrated and running around cursing a blue streak about this, but he performed a great service, and I discovered that in Washington, by the time Grant becomes general-in-chief about a year before the war ends, it's pretty much an open secret in Washington that Rollins has this special role. And I discovered there was a kind of code language that a lot of the generals and politicians used. They always referred to Rollins as Grant's special man, his indispensable man, you know, so they would write to each other, Rollins is Grant's indispensable man, you know what I mean. So, fascinating relationship. And then Rollins, actually, when Grant becomes president, he named Rollins as his Secretary of War, what we now euphemistically call Secretary of Defense.
Julia Grant also spends a lot of time protecting her husband from the rumors, even as she's got to be aware of these benders that he's going on.
Yeah, it's interesting because kind of one, you know, perfect pattern. Grant almost never drinks when John Rollins is around, and never drinks when Julia is around. And I have a story in the book, you know, of Grant waking up one night and to discover Julia, you know, pouring a bottle of whiskey, you know, down the sink. And it's interesting because, you know, I found so much of the discussion about Grant and drinking, it was always Grant a drunkard. And I found that such a kind of loaded, really Victorian word, drunkard, because what it implies is someone who is irresponsible and dissipated, who's kind of freely indulging this vice, rather than a mature adult who's grappling with a chronic condition. And Grant, I discovered, when he was in his 20s, he joined a temperance lodge. The temperance movement was just starting. So this is not someone who was, you know, stumbling through the war in an alcoholic haze, much less someone who was cavalier about this. This was, you know, somebody who, you know, shouldering the gigantic burden, you know, of having a million soldiers under his command, you know, and is trying to win this war while, you know, dealing with something that was a chronic condition. And actually, when he's president, partly because Julia and his, you know, children were there all the time, but the drinking rumors almost entirely stop when he's president. And then, interestingly, he discussed his drinking history with Mark Twain. And Twain wrote in one letter that he was very impressed. He said Grant had so thoroughly conquered the drinking problem that he had lost even the taste, you know, for it. And then I tell the story at the end of the book, because Twain was the publisher of the memoirs. The day of Grant's funeral, Twain is kicking himself, because there's not one word about the drinking problem in the famous memoirs. On the day of the funeral, Twain is kicking himself that he did not prod Grant into talking about the drinking. He felt that Grant should have trusted the public to understand. And they would have, and again, you know, 19th century attitudes towards any kind of, you know, addiction or substance abuse, attitudes so benighted compared to, you know, our understanding, you know, of the medical and hereditary roots of alcoholism, kind of would have been a great service, actually,
right,
to future generations if Grant had, you know, talked about his struggle with alcoholism. But I guess, you know, I can understand, you're dying in excruciating pain from cancer, and that was, you know, tough reality that he did not want to revisit at that moment.
How common is it that you go outside the circle of historical documentation and sources to, you know, to expertise on, in this case, alcoholism? I mean, have you done that with every biography that you've done?
This was, a little bit different, simply because I felt that so many historians had been evasive, you know, about this issue. You know, and unfortunately what I noticed, because there'd been a whole, you know, string of admiring books about Grant in recent years, and I was dismayed by the fact that, you know, the writers who admired Grant felt that, oh, all these drinking stories were invented by malicious, you know, rivals during the war. And actually, when I started the book, I thought that's how I was going to come out. But, you know, between 1967 and 2012, they published 32 very thick volumes of Grant's papers. And it has in these volumes all of the letters, both signed and anonymous, that were being sent to Abraham Lincoln and War Secretary Stanton, et cetera, during the Civil War. And these letters have always sort of been, you know, dismissed as invented whole cloth. And I started looking closely at the letters, and what I noticed, and these were letters written by different people at different times in different places, in other words, people who could not have coordinated what they were writing, and they all described exactly the same personality, almost the identical language. It said Grant was silly drunk, foolishly drunk, idiotically drunk. They all said that he slurred his words. They all said that he stumbled about the room. They all said that this rather tightly buttoned personality would become a rather jovial character, etc. There was not one of these letters, for instance, that described him as a violent drunk or an angry drunk, and we all know that there are plenty of those. So I began to think to myself, oh, my God, these people are all describing recognizably the same person. And so that got me thinking, well, it's possible the letters were being written for malicious, you know, reasons. Mm-hmm. But I began to think, oh, my God, I don't think that these people were inventing. I certainly, and I point out many places in the book where I think that, you know, they were embellishing or exaggerating the story in different ways that were not believable. But I think that many of these letters were based on actual incidents.
When I was out in the audience before we started, there was a lot of curiosity about just your research work, whether you, and now as I hear you talk about reading these letters, do you have a team or is a lot of this done by you?
No, it's me. I'm, you know, chief
wow.
cook and bottle washer, yeah. I'm the whole band. I always have, usually a Columbia writing student, I have a research assistant, but the research assistant merely, and with the internet, it's almost not necessary anymore, will make copies of different articles or chapters from books or things like that. But a lot of my colleagues in the biz who will go nameless, you know, have whole teams of researchers. And I do it all myself, and I do it myself because I find that what I discover in reading a letter or a diary, what I discover is exactly proportionate to my knowledge of the people and the events of the period. That is, historical discoveries do not announce themselves. And I could give one example. When I was doing Hamilton grows up. He's this illegitimate orphan kid. You know, he's working as a poor clerk on St. Croix. He's 17. He then goes to the mainland, and 5 years later, he's working as George Washington's right-hand man. So I thought to myself, gee, everyone on the island of St. Croix must have been buzzing. Remember that kid, Alex, poor clerk, and now he's Washington's right-hand man. So I spent an entire day cranking microfilm in St. Croix. There was a an island newspaper. I cranked microfilm, and I went through every page of every issue during the 8 years of the Revolutionary War, just looking for Hamilton's name. There was not a single reference. But I would get tired, so I would stop, and I would start reading. And I started reading, and I noticed that there were these articles signed A Gentleman from New York. And in one of them, the writer was describing an episode that happened in Lower Manhattan in 1775, in almost verbatim the language that Hamilton had described the same event in a letter to John Jay. And I said, oh my God, the gentleman from New York is Hamilton. And then I found that there were 10 letters, and they all perfectly matched up with letters that he'd written, things happening in his life. So there was no doubt in my mind that Hamilton was the gentleman from New York. Then actually in the final one of them, he said, I'm putting down my pen, you know, and taking up arms, which was exactly the week that Hamilton became a captain in the army. But I said to myself that if I'd, you know, hired someone to go in and do that, even the most conscientious researcher would have called me up at the end of the day and said, Ron, I'm sorry, I didn't find any reference to Hamilton. You know, and it would have been drilling a dry hole. And so I end up doing it all myself.
Nice. So you've brought us all tickets for Hamilton on Broadway, right? Okay, tell the story about how Lin-Manuel Miranda approaches you to write this great hip-hop musical out of that you never saw coming when you published Hamilton.
Oh, no, okay. I always knew there was going to be a hip-hop musical.
You did not.
No, I published the book in 2004, and then 2008, I live in New York. I was out walking in my neighborhood of Brooklyn Heights, and I ran into my friend Gara, whose daughter had gone to Wesleyan with Lin-Manuel. And it was this life-changing conversation because he said, you know, there's this hip-hop artist, Lin-Manuel Miranda, and he's read your Hamilton book, and he's become obsessed, and he wants to meet you. And Lin was still starring in his first show called In the Heights on Broadway, and he invited me to a matinee, and I went backstage. Luckily, I loved the show, and I was very charmed by him. And so I went backstage, and I said, so I gather my book made an impression on you. And he said, Ron, I was reading the book on vacation in Mexico. He said, as I was reading it, hip-hop songs started rising off the page. Wow. And I said to him, really? and Lin has this very sort of earnest style of talking. He said, you know, Ron, Hamilton's life is a classic hip-hop narrative. And I'm thinking to myself, pal, I have no idea what you're talking about. None whatsoever. And then, to my amazement, you know, he asked me to be on the spot the historical advisor to this non-existent show. You know, so I laughed and I said to him, "You mean you want me to tell you when something's wrong?" And he said, "Yes." He said, "I want the historians to take this seriously." But I could see, you know, if he had wanted to do a kind of satirical or outrageous treatment of Hamilton, I would not have been interested. But I could see that he shared exactly my fascination with the character. But I said to him, I mean, I think Lin quickly realized he had this sort of world-class ignoramus about hip-hop on his hands. And so I said to him, can hip-hop be the vehicle for telling this kind of complex story? And he said, Ron, I'm going to educate you in hip-hop. And he started to on the spot, and he pointed out a number of things that are still very pertinent to the show. Started pointing out that hip-hop, there are more words per measure than any other musical form, so you can pack an enormous amount of information into a small space. Started pointing out that there's a lot of rhyme. There's rhymed endings. There's internal rhyme. There's a lot of, you know, wordplay. So he began to get me very, very interested in the form. But of course, I had thought when the book came out, I thought it would probably be a feature film or a TV series. Then I started working with Lin, and I mean, I was very intrigued. I thought, isn't this fun? I'm going to be part of a show. But you know, I never dreamt, and Lin never dreamt that it was going to be a blockbuster,
I know.
You know, on this scale. And the whole Hamilton phenomenon not only continues, it just keeps expanding. And somehow I found myself in the middle of it.
Is it true that he came over to your apartment with the first song?
Yeah.
Yeah, but what happened?
Well, he came over to my apartment, and he sat on my living room couch, and he started snapping his fingers, and this is what he sang. How does a bastard orphan, son of a whore, and a Scotsman dropped in the middle of a forgotten spot in the Caribbean by Providence impoverished in squalor, grew up to be a hero and a scholar. The $10 founding father without a father got a lot farther by working a lot harder, by being a lot smarter, by being a self-starter. By 14, they placed him in charge of a trading charter. And every day while slaves were being slaughtered and carted away across the waves, he struggled and kept his guard up. Inside, he was longing for something to be a part of. The brother was ready to beg, steal, borrow, and barter. Anyway, it goes on like that.
No, keep on going. Oh, my gosh. That was great.
I've told them many, many times that I'm ready to go on stage. I think Glenn feels I should be doing bar mitzvahs and weddings. Not that. But anyway, you know, he finished singing the song, which is a 4-minute song. And he said to me, "What do you think?" And I said, "Lynn, I think that's the most extraordinary thing I've ever heard in my life. You've taken the first 40 pages of my book and you've kind of shrink-wrapped them into this, you know, 4-minute song." And frankly, you know what I was thinking, but I did not say this to Lynn. I was thinking, "Buddy, either you write very tight or I write very long." You know, it was a little bit embarrassing that he had, accurately condensed 40 pages of writing into this 4-minute song. So it's just great working with Lynn. We had a wonderful working relationship, and he was always I was always touched how faithful he was to the book. And it's not that there's a lot of dramatic license in the show, but Lynn always started out from the presumption that the most dramatic way to tell the story was to stick as closely to the story as possible. And I think that we both felt that this was a story that was so unbelievable that there was no improving on it. But what happens is, there are changes because you're doing a show, you have to have 8 or 10 principal characters, everything has to happen by them, to them, through them. You know, in my book, I have hundreds of characters, so that inevitably, you know, there are changes that are made. But I was really struck by how much good, accurate history made its way into the final version.
Questions? I think we have, we have microphone up here in the balconies, and I'll be down on this side. And whatever you want to know from Ron.
Did Grant make enough from his memoir to support his widow?
Yeah, it's a very good question. In fact, he didn't live to see the publication of the memoirs, but the personal memoirs of Ulysses S. Grant became probably the greatest bestseller of the 19th century. I think the only book that kind of might rival it would have been Uncle Tom's Cabin. Mark Twain had, a year before Grant died, Mark Twain had established a publishing company, Charles Webster and Company, with his nephew. And Twain knew that Grant's memoirs were going to be a great bestseller. The memoirs were sold in kind of 2-volume box sets, and they're sold by subscription. And what Twain very cleverly did, he had all of these Union veterans going knocking door to door. Everyone knew the story both of Grant having cancer and Grant having been wiped out financially. And so all of these Union veterans were knocking on doors and saying to other veterans, you know, "Will you subscribe to the general's, you know, memoirs?" And so they sold 300,000 of those 2-volume box sets. Now, mind you, that would be impressive enough right now when the population of the United States is about 330 million. But at the time, I think the population was about 40 million. So if you extrapolate from it, it was absolutely staggering. And it was certainly the most copies of a book that had been sold in such a short period of time, so that Twain handed Julia Grant a check for, it was either $400,000 or $450,000, which would be approximately equivalent to maybe at least $10 million today. Yes, I agree.
Right up there in the balcony.
Mr. Chernow, tell us more about the reconstruction, please. What did Grant get right? What did he get wrong? And what, from our perspective, do we wish we had been done differently?
Well, I think that, as I said, you know, before at Carrie, I think that what he got right was protecting the 4 million freed slaves, you know, who had become full-fledged American citizens, you know, with the right to vote. What happened, as I said, there was a violent backlash in the South. And what I didn't mention was that there was also a strong, not violent, but a very strong backlash in the North. And it was actually the liberal wing of his own party, the Republican Party. It was the liberal wing that began to lose faith in Reconstruction and tired of sending, you know, federal troops into the South to protect blacks. So I think that Grant, it was a very far-sighted and also very courageous act of presidential leadership, because he was really fighting critics both from the opposition party, which was not unexpected because the white South was Democratic, but he was actually fighting, you know, his own base. And I think that he carried Reconstruction as far as he possibly could. And then what happens in the famous contested election of 1876, the Republican candidate, Rutherford B. Hayes, becomes president in this disputed election by cutting a deal with the South. There were three contested states, believe it or not. Florida was one of the contested states, right? The more things change, the more they seem the same. And those three southern states, you know, go over to the Republican candidate. But in exchange, Rutherford B. Hayes gives the South a guarantee that he will pull federal troops from the South, and that effectively rings down the curtain on Reconstruction. And then what happens is that there is a period up until the 1950s where the South is essentially frozen in this system of apartheid. And what astonished me, you know, doing the book, was that there was a whole civil rights movement in the South that has been completely forgotten, even by very well-educated Americans. I'll give you one example. In 1867, this was actually before Grant became president, but he was general in chief, the South had been carved up into five military districts. And the chief of the Louisiana-Texas district was Phil Sheridan, who had been one of the main Union generals. I read a letter that Sheridan writes to Grant in 1867. Dear General, we desegregated public streetcars in New Orleans today. He proceeds to tell Grant that up until that time, blacks and whites had ridden on separate streetcars, and he described how the black streetcars had these big stars emblazoned on the side. He said what began to happen spontaneously was that blacks in protest began to pour onto the white-only streetcars. The streetcar companies then turned to Sheridan and appealed to him to stop this. And Sheridan, to his credit, said to the streetcar companies that unless they allowed blacks and whites to ride side by side on streetcars, that he was going to ban these streetcars from New Orleans. And he ends the letter to Grant by saying, well, we had a little ruckus at the beginning, he said, but now everyone is cheerfully adapted and blacks and whites are happily sitting on streetcars together. Okay, let's pause 1 second. What I just described to you happened almost 90 years before Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat on that Montgomery bus, which we're always led to believe was the first time that had ever happened. And I'm not knocking Rosa Parks, goodness knows, what she did was great and courageous. But we had had an entire civil rights movement going on in this country, including those blacks pouring onto white-only buses, nameless blacks. You know, so many Americans know about the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, but they don't realize we had a Civil Rights Act of 1866, we had a Civil Rights Act of 1875 that banned segregation in public accommodations and transportations, juries, etc. This is why I was saying at the beginning, Americans know so much about the Civil War, but Reconstruction is a black hole, and we really need to know what happened, because there were sort of very inspirational things that were going on before the South then reverts back to this really system of apartheid that then freezes everything, you know, for an 80 or 90 year period before Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement come along and finally end it.
Question right here.
What was Grant's relationship with McClellan?
Grant's relationship with McClellan was not good because McClellan, back in the 1850s, in other words, in the years before the Civil War, Grant is posted to an army garrison outside of Portland, and George McClellan is in charge of a survey, a railroad survey for the Northern Pacific Railroad. And Grant, as quartermaster, has to put together the horses and mules for this survey. McClellan happens to see Grant, you know, drinking, and this makes a permanent impression on him. There was a very active rumor mill in the regular army, and McClellan did not forget this. And so after Grant wins these famous back-to-back battles at Fort Henry and then Fort Donelson, Henry Halleck, who was then became chief of staff, McClellan said that he wanted a daily report on troop strength. Halleck tells Grant. Grant never actually gets this message because of a Confederate spy in the telegraph office. And McClellan immediately says to Halleck, and here Grant has just won really the first great Union victory of the war. And McClellan writes to Halleck and says, if Grant won't give us the reports, not only should you reprimand him, but arrest him immediately, which was really crazy. One thing that I found, and of course, Grant's nature as a general was completely the opposite of McClellan. McClellan was always kind of training the troops and having these fancy reviews. Grant was kind of very, you know, plain-spoken. Grant was aggressive. McClellan was always, you know, finding excuses not to attack. Grant was always very ready to attack. One nice thing I discovered during the book, when Grant became president, by that point McClellan had been forced out. Grant had not only great military instinct, but he already had a great political instinct, because he says to Lincoln that he would like to rehire McClellan. He thought it was very important for morale in the Union Army that all of these generals, you know, who had been cashiered for their failures, that it was important to reincorporate them back into the Army. But actually it turned out that they did not want to come back, so that never happened. You'll find it very interesting, because McClellan's record was really dismal during the Civil War, when Robert E. Lee, whose army had been captured by Ulysses S. Grant, was asked after the war who was the greatest Union general. Guess who he said? George McClellan, who had no luck whatsoever in fighting Lee.
Question right down there in the front.
So quick and sincere thank you for your writing. And you've helped bring something in common between my son and myself and now my husband and our love for reading. So I quickly texted him, said, I may be able to ask a question. What should I ask? Mm-hmm. And he said, oh, who is he interested in writing about in the future? So, thank you.
My mind is just so full of Grant at the moment that I think that I'm just going to concentrate on that, but come up to me afterwards if you have ideas. I'm kind of open to all comers.
Question up there in the balcony.
I'd like to ask about the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms by a well-regulated state militia. Yeah. It's my understanding that that was added to the Constitution by the slave states for the purposes of the slave patrols. Is that true?
The wording in the Second Amendment?
Yes.
Well, that wording went back to, James Madison, you know, well-regulated militia being necessary. No, that was in the, original Bill of Rights back in, 1791. One interesting thing that I found, you know, because in general I'm kind of a great supporter of gun control. But one interesting thing that I found doing the book is that after the Civil War, and this is really kind of a precursor of Jim Crow, the Southern states begin to pass so-called black codes. And the black codes are essentially kind of pushing the black community back onto their old plantations, so that a black can be arrested if he cannot show an employment contract for a year. They pass all of these laws that really plunge the black community back into a form of servitude. And as part of these black codes, blacks were forbidden from owning arms during that period. And there were actually some black conservatives who were kind of strong Second Amendment, you know, supporters and, you know, kind of very broad interpretation, you know, who kind of point back to that precedent, you know, that for the black community in the South, that they had been kind of stripped of their, you know, rights to bear arms. And there's kind of truth in that. Again, I'm still kind of a big supporter of gun control, but it's kind of a point that I notice has been made on the right, and there is some justification in history for that.
Question right over here.
My question to you is on Grant's belief on federal Indian policy.
Yeah.
It's interesting, when I study Grant, it seems like he's one of the top 10 worst presidents for federal Indian policy. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, I hear what you say on what he did for African Americans and slaves. And I'm kind of wondering, was it based on maybe the people that were surrounding him, or?
Very good question. Because I think that it's a case of, you know, wonderful intentions, very bad outcome, you know, and this is the story. As I indicated before, you know, the whole cast of characters, all of the, you know, Union generals from the Civil War, they then kind of reappear after the war, you know, fighting the Indians. The kind of the regular army is turned against the Indian population. And so many of the generals, particularly Grant's, you know, two main commanders during the war, Sheridan and Sherman, their attitude toward Native Americans is just completely bloodthirsty. You know, Sheridan is supposed to have said, you know, the only good Indian is a dead Indian. Sherman, in one of his letters, writes to Sheridan. He said, well, the more Indians we kill this year, you know, the fewer we'll have to kill next year. So Grant's policies are being carried out by a particularly bloodthirsty set of generals on this issue. Okay, Grant becomes general. He's full of good intentions. Grant, I think, as much as any, you know, American president in the 19th century, was deeply sympathetic toward Native Americans. He often said that the Indians needed to be protected against the white man at least as much as the white man had to be protected against the Indians. He made strong statements, like he said, I can't believe that God put, you know, different races on earth so that stronger races could exterminate the weaker races. What he wanted to do, he had a policy that of what he called Christianizing, civilizing the Indians. What he basically wanted to do, because the Indians were a hunting-gathering society, he wanted the Indians to go to reservations and essentially become settled agricultural communities, and they would learn, you know, English, etc. Very kind of well intentioned on Grant's part, and Grant never made racist comments about Native Americans. But for the Native American communities, it was kind of a suicide pact, because he was saying, you know, to them basically that they had to give up their, you know, traditional culture to survive. What Grant was caught in, I think, really a tragic bind, because during the years of his presidency after the Civil War, there are tremendous forces pushing settlement out west. You have a tremendous wave of settlers, you know, moving across the Midwest and into the far west. You had mining companies and railroad companies. These were all very, very powerful political constituencies. And after all, these were voters, which the Native Americans were not. And they were demanding protection. And a lot of the Native Americans did not want to give up the hunting and gathering. And Grant, you know, said to them, look, you know, the days are over where you're going to roam across wide areas chasing the buffalo, because you're just going to keep clashing with the railroads and the mining companies and the white settlers. Finally, what happens, the story could not have a sadder ending. In July 1876, in other words, Grant's last year in office, William Armstrong Custer, whom Grant did not like, Custer and his men are massacred at Little Bighorn. What happens is that news starts, you know, filtering east. There is, in all the newspapers and then in the halls of Congress, there's a tremendous hue and cry, and there is just one bloodthirsty cry, which is for revenge. So any chance of having a more peaceful solution of this problem is ruled out. And then, you know, many people in Congress are calling for outright extermination of the Indians after Little Bighorn. So I wish that, so, you know, I completely understand, you know, historians have written about this period, and it's a very, very sad history of the federal government with the Native Americans. And kind of what makes it sadder is that Grant was full of sympathy for Native Americans and good intentions, but at the end of the day, it counted for little.
How do you feel about three more questions, Ron? Can we do that?
I feel fine.
All right, great.
If the audience can hold up, I'm doing fine.
Okay, and there will be a book signing after, just to let you know, right over there.
Hi. First of all, thank you so much. What a great night. And as a transplanted East Coaster here from New Jersey and New York, I'm so curious to know about your personal history. What drove you to research this, and about growing up on the East Coast? How did you delve in, and how did you decide to delve into these presidents, and what stimulated you to research these brilliant people in our history?
Well, it's a very good question in terms of how I choose subjects, because as a biographer, there's no more important decision that I make in terms of choice of subject. And anytime I address a group of writing students who are would-be biographers, I always say writing biography is a lot like marriage. If you choose the right partner, nothing can go wrong, but choose the wrong partner and nothing can go right. There's so much that flows out of that. And I have a lot of different requirements in terms of what I'm looking for. I have to feel that I can produce a fresh portrait. I have to feel that I could produce a lot of new information. I have to feel that there are a lot of papers that have not been consulted before. And I have a kind of contrarian streak in my nature. Because what happens, you know, with so many historical figures over the course of time, the view of that figure congeals into a historical consensus. And that's kind of often where I feel my opportunity is to kind of come along and have a reappraisal. You know, with Grant, I had a very similar feeling as with Hamilton. When I was doing Hamilton, it's funny now because he's the darling of Broadway and his name is up in lights on marquees. But when I started working on Hamilton in 1998, he was a forgotten figure. To the extent he was remembered, he was misunderstood, he was villainized. Everyone thought that Jefferson was wonderful and Hamilton was terrible. And I really felt that Hamilton had not gotten his due. Of course, I did not see Lin-Manuel Miranda coming along and helping in that whole project. And I had a similar feeling about Ulysses S. Grant, that he was really ripe for a reappraisal.
Question right up there in the balcony.
Going off that last question, when you first start your research, what's the first text that you decide to study to dive into a person? Do you look at them on Wikipedia, or how does that first text kind of influence how you're going to view that person throughout your research?
Well, actually, with Grant, it sounds commonsensical, but the first thing that I did was cross-read Grant's personal memoirs. And after I had been, you know, working just for a few weeks on the book, I ran into a friend who said to me, "Ron, how do you write a great biography about someone who's written a great autobiography?" And I have to say that stopped me dead in my tracks for a few days. But then what I realized, it actually turned out to be a very, very helpful comment because, well, number one, Grant's memoirs are not to be confused with an autobiography. I mean, he omits small things like his two-term presidency, really about his childhood, Mexican War, and the Civil War. So it pretty much ends with Appomattox. But what I realized, what my job was as a biographer, was to talk about everything that Grant did not want to talk about. So there's not, for instance, as I said, a word about his lifelong struggle with alcohol. Also, I was talking about that period in St. Louis where he fails at one business after another and he's selling firewood on street corners. If you look at the memoirs, Grant skips over that in about two sentences. So it actually, that comment was very useful because it kind of sharpened my perspective, and I realized that the sweet spot of my biography was kind of that tension between what he wanted to talk about and, you know, what I wanted to talk about, which is often the things that he, you know, for one reason or another, wanted to avoid.
And one last question right here.
Okay. Good evening. Do you have a favorite among the three men that you've written about?
Well, I've written about more than three. this is actually my seventh book and my sixth biography. And it's a very good question. And I have to say, because usually in the past, I've been very coy when asked, you know, do you have a favorite subject, favorite book? And I've always kind of retreated into the author platitude about loving all my children equally, whether I believe that or not. It was the first time saying this publicly. Grant was my favorite. I think it's the most dramatic story. It's just kind of wall-to-wall drama and adventure. The personal story is amazing. And I also think that I feel that way because, as I was saying, I felt that all the other people that I had written about, they were kind of built for success. They had this drive and focus and ambition, and they just kind of kept going from strength to strength. Grant has the highs of the other book, but this book has lows, so low. I mean, he just keeps hitting, you know, bottom again and again and again. And so for me, there's the pathos of a sensitive and fundamentally decent man who's repeatedly defeated by circumstance until finally circumstance, you know, comes around to him. And it really kind of got under my skin. There's a kind of poignance and a pathos that is completely unlike anything that I've had the opportunity to write about in my life. And I really responded to it. And I think that I responded to him so strongly. You know, it's always easy to praise people who are genuinely modest and self-effacing, and Ulysses S. Grant was such a man.
Talking Volumes is sponsored by Bremer Bank, Becker Furniture World, Hamline University, and Love Your Melon.